Listen, man, it's simple. We got three kinds of things that we do. We got proper things, which start with the start off. We got guidance, which you just go into. And then there's the other thing, which depends. Let's try doing this for realsies this time. Hello, hello, and welcome. I'm Nick.
I'm Ryan.
And welcome to the Acoustic Studios podcast coverage of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute Game Fest 2011.
The final battle.
Yeah, the time that we went there and I had a game in it. So you were there, what'd you think? Just jump right into it, headlong.
Well, just in general?
Yeah, because I got a list of the games here. We can cover them one by one. We can say which ones were crap and which ones were all right.
But I'm glad that you do, because I have nothing, and you know how my memory is.
Yep.
The one thing that sticks out in my mind is Yamada Box Legend.
Really?
Yes.
Is that because they built a house out of boxes?
Yeah, everyone else had, like, you know, their tables set up and everything. They had laptops, and then Yamada Box Legend. I don't even remember what their game was like. I think it was, like, a 3D platformer with some kind of, like, scaling gimmick. I don't know.
I think they had
a fortress made out of cardboard boxes.
Yeah, their game was something about an adventure game that was like that one episode of Futurama where alternate universes lay inside of cardboard boxes. That's basically exactly what their game was, I hear.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They came... So the first night of RPI, for our listening audience, or of Game Fest, rather, was the actual sort of game fest and exhibition part, where all the student creative projects were shown. And then the next day was a whole bunch of talks from dudes in the industry and an award ceremony for games from the previous night. And the amount of Box Legend, I think, actually came in second or third.
Really?
Yeah. Which almost makes me wonder why I didn't go play it, because it might have been good. And then I remember when I saw everybody come up on stage, I was like, oh, because it's a whole bunch of fucking hipsters who made this game. Like, hipsters punks. So many piercings. So many not giving a fuck about they just won an award. Like, it wasn't even how they looked, it was how they behaved.
Oh. Okay.
They built a house out of boxes on a floor, and they did it poorly.
And then they won an award.
Yeah.
That's seem bitter.
I am
jealous.
Because we did not place at all.
Seriously?
Yeah.
You got, like, featured on the TV.
Yeah, we did.
Dudes from Vicarious Visions were like, these guys got potential.
They said, we probably have more potential than we even know. This is for our game, VS Nitros. But that we had a long way to go. And I guess other people had less potential, but we're already there.
Less of a ways to go. Okay.
Yeah, I guess that's what. Because that seems to be the way that what games were actually graded on were just their amount of polish. Because the game the People's Choice Award judging was Tick.
Which one was Tick? Oh, is that the one that's going on X-Bla?
Yeah.
Okay.
The one with the little helicopter robot.
Yes. I didn't actually play that.
Very simple. Very strange, not altogether exciting. It was another game that still felt like a student project. But there was one thing that they had, which pretty much no one else had. An intro movie.
Oh. I thought you were going to say an attractive girl running the booth. Because Jesse wouldn't shut up about her.
But yeah, so they kind of got a shutout. So that means they got the $500 and $100 bonus prize.
Oh, what?
Yeah, I know. And yet, like, the people who actually made the game were not the ones who were sitting there at the booth. Like, those are just people who they got to show up and watch it. People
who didn't
give a crap. Yeah, it's... I'm going to chew these Mike and Ike's angrily for a minute. Arr.
Okay, well, let's get off that.
It was a well-put-together game, but...
Let's talk about things that we liked that happened there. You know, games that we
like
saw...
Like Purgatory.
Like what?
Purgatory.
Yeah, and that board game won.
Hexabus. Yeah, Hexabus actually got fifth place.
Really?
Yeah. That was pretty cool.
Have you played the print version since?
Have not yet played it, but at the same time, it reminds me of that really old game Hexagon.
That's just a shape. It reminds you of a shape, Nick.
No. There was a game. It was played on a hexagon. It was played on that shape. Mm-hmm. But it was just like, both players start with three pieces on the board. And then you could either choose to move to an adjacent space, which makes a copy of a piece, or move two spaces away, which jumps your piece.
Okay.
And then when, at the end of it, at the end of your turn, any pieces that are touching where you move to of the opponent's side are turned to your color. And then it's about when the game board is filled, whoever has the most colored pieces is the winner.
Okay. So, kind of like a different take on Othello, basically.
Yeah. Which is what that game was. This game has the same kind of movement about, like, copy or jump. Or they have, like, a slide mechanic where when you move a piece adjacently, it moves all of the pieces touching it in the same direction.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's kind of like, rather than trying to fill the board, there's a set amount of pieces, and you can actually kill pieces by shoving them into death pits.
Hmm.
And in the end, you're trying to get a piece to sit on top of their king piece.
Oh, so you can slide enemy pieces as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
And apparently you get, like, a move and an action on a turn. So you can either, like, move, because throwing people is an action, apparently.
Yes.
Even though it's all based on movement. So that means you can, like, combo, like, slide people somewhere where you can throw them, and then you throw them into death pits.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah. But it's weird, because they made a board game. Mm-hmm. The only thing sort of virtual about that is they built the AI to go behind it.
Well, yeah. I mean, whatever.
I guess, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know. Are you opening the door to say that, well, now any kind of game is allowed? What if I put Ultimate Frisbee into the show? Would that get an award?
Well, like, I mean, if you made, you know, an Ultimate Frisbee video game, yes.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying.
I mean, you know, maybe, you know, the fact that it's a board game, okay, they're not really... What am I trying to think of here? They're not really using all of the potential that they have, you know, being in a digital medium sort of thing. But whatever. I don't think you should stop them from making a board game.
No, I think board games are awesome. I like making board games. But, I don't know, it's just like, as far as I can tell, like, that's kind of just... They said, the Vicarious Vision guy says that the thing that really sort of helped them judge on this one was that they were able to take a copy of it home and play it.
Mm.
And I was like, we put our game on the internet! I'm sorry, I'm still bitter. I'm a biased reporter.
Pat, it's okay. I am also fairly biased, because I think your game's pretty rad, but I also did not lose out on, like, $500 or whatever. So yeah. Maybe a little less biased.
So let's look at some of these other games that were there.
There was Purgatory, which we were Purgatory both pretty fond of.
Yeah, because, like, they actually had, like, a level progression and stages to go through, but all they had up was kind of, like, a one-room tech demo, but it was really awesome, because it had a grappling hook and a knockabout sword and physics.
Yeah, the guy we were talking to said that he wanted to make, like, a side-scrolling brawler kind of inspired by, like, Devil May Cry and action games like that, where you have a lot of aerial action and knocking guys around and combos and stuff. So, what we saw in the game was that you don't actually have any direct way to kill enemies, but you can, like, grapple and throw dudes into the air and knock them into spikes and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
It's one of those cases of a really simple system that then allows for a lot of emerging gameplay. Like, when you knock a guy into the air, and then you catch him with the grappling hook, and he pulls you up into the air, and then you can jump higher off of that.
You orbit around each other, and then you hurl him into a spike wall.
A double orbit Mobius jump throw. That's awesome! So it would have been nice to play the whole thing.
Yeah.
Apparently he had no plans to put it online or anything.
That's
so,
just kind of a shame.
Yeah, but that kid, he's a strange one. He doesn't seem aware of his, like, major potential, because he's made a lot of good things in the past, and he's, like, actually a pretty talented coder.
But he just kind of leaves him around.
Yeah, sometimes he's just like, yeah, I guess I'm done with that, what's next?
Okay. He needs to get, he needs to get a partner in crime.
Needs to find something he's dedicated to or something.
Yeah.
Aside from...
Yeah, I'd like to play that, because it also had, like, that sort of, you know, platformer with sometimes it says mysterious shit about your past and stuff
going
on, which is like, Time for Cuck or other games like that, which I've enjoyed.
Mm. Yeah. Well, 7 Minutes to Live was a pretty good one.
I don't remember that one.
It was like, it was just like a simple platformer, but as you go, there's just this big demon face is telling you, like, why are you going anywhere? You won't get anywhere. You only have 7 minutes to live. And then at the very end of the game, it's a dead end and he kills you.
Oh, I think I do remember that one, actually.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a thing. Did you see... Let's look at some of the other ones on this list here. Did you play what my roommate Evan did?
Oh, the minecart one?
No, my other roommate.
Oh.
He made like a... He basically made like 5 or 6 maps in UDK that were about trying to guide the player.
Okay.
So he just kind of like made like 5 big maze maps. You start at one point, there's an end at another point. And then he was like... He made one map where like... There were light posts through the forest.
Just for clarification, UDK, that's the Unity Dev Kit or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you, it's like, it's the Unity 3 engine tools.
Okay. Just for the kids at home.
Yeah. So like he made these maps that were mazes, and then one map was like, there are a series of light posts hidden in a forest, and then it's like, are those going to guide you? There's another one where there was like a glowing energy ball that as you got close to it, it would run away a bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one where there was like sort of like a cleared path of like fallen trees in the forest. And basically, he was just playing with different ways to guide the player without putting like a big arrow or saying, you know, or putting way markers.
Yeah,
it was pretty good. Apparently, he actually got some good stuff out of it, and people really like to chase a glowing ball.
Cool.
So there was that. Did you play Kella Kona?
No.
Me neither. It looked like there was some sort of dragon lady, and it didn't look good, and it looked like it was kind of boring.
Oh. Okay. Wow. Sorry, Kella Kona.
That's sort of the thing. Like, a lot of... There's a feel that student games get, where just, like, sort of, like, really under-textured... Like, looking at the stuff that the Game Fest put out and looking at some of the stuff from, like, DigiPen, there's always, like, a feel that a lot of poor student games have, where, like hugely under-textured, like, there's always, like, clunky physics. Sometimes you get, I don't know, it always...
I see what
they always feel
at.
Really clunky. And, like, there's a certain feel to them.
I remember
which,
there was a fighting game there,
it was like twin blades.
Oh yeah, that the animations in that one. We played that one. It was like a co-op dungeon crawly thing.
Yeah.
And like the animations were really, I don't even know, just bad, I guess.
Yeah. But and like they still get a lot of credit because they did make a game.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of work in itself, even to make sort of a poor, mediocre one. Like, you can make something, and it's just unplayable garbage, and that is a failure. But they made a game.
Yeah.
Two Sword Fury, that's what it's called.
Okay.
And, like, they had a good thing going. They had the dungeon crawling. They had a boss at the end. They had co-op bits, I guess.
They had that maze where you had to find the levers and shit.
Yeah, but then, you know, it has a thing where it's like the power bar to let you know when your fireball is recharged is just, like, a rectangle with no words or numbers or gradients or anything around it. It's got, you know, sometimes animations will keep playing and there's no, like, feedback to let you know that you're actually hitting a guy or that you've been hit. It's little things, like little feedback things that make you think, like, oh, I'm playing something which is hard to play because I have to put more work in to figure out what's going on. It always feels more like a work in progress than something that's finished. Mm. And I think a number of games had that going on. Do you know which one Mountain was or Let My Monster Grow? I don't remember either of those.
No.
Let
My Monster Grow.
Yeah. There was Robot Glacier Fortress.
I saw that one. It had everything that it was promising.
And Ninja Ropes.
Yeah.
So that might have been cool. Didn't get a chance to play it, though.
And what was the... It was like a platformer with teleporting. What was that one? Shift? It was
Blinkman.
Blinkman. Blinkman seemed cool.
Yeah, I didn't get to play that one either, but that one had a really nice sort of level of polish on it.
Yeah, it like really things likes, are happening. Like the environmental art. It was all it like was... these skyscrapers and glowing things and Blinkman.
Mm. And they had it where they were teaching you by showing. So it was like, here, try to jump into this energy field. Oh, you shouldn't do that. If you do something bad, I'm just going to save you. That's what we do instead of dying in this game. But still, they had, like, examples and sort of learn as you play rather than having a wall of text and be like, here, read this first and you can play.
Yeah.
Which was kind of the problem with our game.
Yeah.
Have
we talked about Virus Slayer Nitros in depth on the podcast? Do you want to?
Kind of in depth. I will say that if people want to play, they can go to vsnitros.com, and you can play online right there. And it's a game about puzzle, like, panel de pawn puzzle action, and then sort of run around brawling action, except with energy vortices, so it's
indirect. I don't
want
to install the Unity web player right now, sorry.
Oh, okay, fine. But it's online, you can play it. It's important to remember, it is about the flow. You're in action mode, you activate tiles. Go to puzzle mode, you make matches using those tiles. Then you go back to action mode, and there will be kickballs that you use to hurt the enemies.
I like
this is
that,
a three-step process that
I like
flows.
That you call them kickballs, even though they're like glowing energy spheres that sap energy out of, you know, anthropomorphic computer viruses.
Yeah.
You know, just like a kickball.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's...
You don't even kick it. You shield bop it.
Yeah. Like, because that was, like, one of the last things that we put in. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the things where it was like, well, here's a solution that we didn't really plan on, nobody has a heart set on, but it does fix everything that was wrong. And so we're just like, yeah, kickballs, all right. Even though I think in canon they are known as energy vortices.
The very deep in
Virus Slayer Nitro's canon.
VSN canon.
A VSN canon. That's our sequel. It's a game about cannons.
Okay.
With Angry Birds, and then when you land, you have to beat somebody up.
It's Angry Birds, but you fire birds at tiles to flip them around, and each tile has a different color on each face, and then you don't move tiles, you just flip them to try to make combinations.
Oh, boy.
And then when you make combinations, they fall off and fall onto the green pigs.
We need some sort of more physics aspects to that. But yes, okay, fine. Oh no, I dropped a mic. Or is it a mic?
Oh, god damn it.
Like, I saw some of these games in development, because our class was one of the ones where everybody was in the show,
mm-hmm.
even if they weren't in the competition. There was Bounty Quest and Untitled Track, and those games were sort of mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bounty Quest started out as a game where like you were going around to different cultures and stealing sacred objects because you were a pirate.
Okay.
And I guess that's kind of how it ended, except it changed over the course. Like, it was one of those games where it's like, in talking about it, she was like, well, I changed this because I didn't like this idea, and I wanted to do this, and it was easier for me to draw sprites like this. And yet the game itself never changed. Because she spent, like, 4 or 5 presentations using the same colored boxes and the same 4 levels. And those are levels that made it into the final game. The only difference between any of those initial presentations and what she finally showed was just sprites were actually put in. Everything else happened kind of just in her head.
So she just overthought things and didn't really...
And didn't, you know, change much of the game so much as the ideas that she was going to put into the game. Which, you know, in some ways, a lot of people will say if you come at it from a narrative perspective, then yes, that can be just as important decisions. But I like mechanics a lot, so I don't really care about what story people say. There was... And then Untitled Track, similarly, she kind of made a game at the beginning and then left it that way. And that's kind of what she ended up with, except she put in even less effort than the other one, so it was kind of just a bad run-right dodge stuff on it. Like, it's kind of like the tutorial game that they teach you how to make in order to use the program. So, I... Then again, there was also Cyber Limbo there.
Cyber Limbo?
Cyber Limbo.
Was that one of the Kinect games?
No, it wasn't. It was one of the games where you... Okay, so the story is you die on the internet. You die on the internet. And I guess that means you die in real life.
Okay.
But you're sort of like in internet... You're in cyber limbo, which means you now have the opportunity to go back through your internet life and try to sort of atone for your internet sins.
Okay.
So this means, like, you go to Facebook... And, you know, you delete all of the mean wall posts, you go to Twitter and you take down, you know, stop following all those porn Twitter bots, you go to MySpace and you make it look not so much like I'm melting crap.
Yeah.
And then the final boss is just your browser history. So, kind of good, except it was also kind of just like, there were four levels, two of them were, like, there were two sets of two that were the same.
What was the gameplay like? Like, you're describing this, and I'm thinking, like, a point-and-click adventure.
No, like, one was just, like, jumping around on the YouTube player bars. One was jumping around on Twitter. The Facebook and the Twitter one were the same, because you're just falling and dodging, blinking bad words and hands. If you've ever seen, like, crappy net art, the game was basically that. So even though, like the premise... was kind of solid, and you could do something with that, he made, like, a shitty net art game. Which, to be fair, that's all of the stuff that he does. Like, he considers himself a net artist.
I don't really know what that means.
Look up Corey Archangel, I think was his name. Yeah, he took a cartridge of Super Mario Brothers for the NES and just hacked it. So instead of playing a game, it would just display the clouds in the background and just scroll them across the screen infinitely. So I'll put a link to a video of Corey explaining some of his works in the show notes, and you can get what I mean by that. But basically, there's a lot of net art, which is just sort of bad things, like wrong colors and jaggy edges and, like, making things look ugly on purpose. And I'm not sure why people do that and why it is accepted. And that's kind of what this kid's game was. Now, I have seen worse. And he did make a game earlier in the semester, which I thought was kind of hilarious. It is a game where you play as a man whose family died when a boat drowned. So he takes a gun and he runs towards the sea. And you can't win, because you always run into the sea and drown. But the faster you press space, the more shots you fire at the sea before you drown, and the higher score you get.
That's pretty cool.
And that's pretty okay. Like, it's not, you know, it's not, it is sort of an art that is a pretty good art, but that is also the best thing I saw of his.
I kind of want to go back and talk to you about what you just said, like, 2 minutes ago.
Which part?
About why you don't understand why purposely making things kind of shitty is accepted.
Like I know that there is a reason for it, but it is maybe not accepted, maybe conceived, because it's like
you read Homestuck, right?
Yeah,
there is a lot of purposely shitty art in that comic.
I know, but. But there's it's sort of, okay, a guy makes a piece of art. The piece of art is a bucket of human feces that just sits there on the floor, and you are like invited to stick your hand in it. Like in concept, yes, maybe there's meaning behind that, maybe you are saying something, maybe it's a good thing. But then it's sort of like one of those high concept pieces where it's like yes, if somebody did that would be amazing. But then somebody actually does that and it is nowhere near as amazing as the idea of it is. It is one of those things that you should think about it, say this would be a good idea, and then not do it. And that leaves it as being a good idea.
Okay, fair enough. I don't know.
Or like anytime you see a video, which is like possibly any Jean-Luc Godard film, like the one where it is just people driving by scenes of cars on fire. Like, there's probably meaning in that. He has made it so that it is hard to find that meaning unless you come from a very particular background where you instantly pick up on it. And it goes on for so long that it isn't even just sort of an example. It is, like, being long is the point of it. That is what makes it bad. That is what makes it good. You know, if you go too many steps, you are just getting the part that makes it bad and not the part that makes it good. If I had more actual examples, I think this would make more sense, but this is one of my arguments.
Okay.
Against art.
Just in general.
No, okay, maybe not against art. Maybe against intellectuals. No, not against semi-intellectuals. People who are smart enough to get it, but not smart enough to get that doing it is a bad idea. I think these people exist. You remember any other games? Let's talk about those Kinect games. Because there were two of them.
Yeah, there was one that was like a breakout game where you used your body to bop balls, only then when you broke tiles, they turned into more balls to bop.
And so just became a giant ball pit.
It just turned into like an uncontrollable clusterfuck. And most people seem to have fun by trying to enclose the balls in, like, you know, the shadow of their body and watching the game bug out when you did that.
Yeah. It was kind of a cool thing. Yeah. But then there was Rail Brawler. Did you get to watch some Rail Brawler?
I saw Big Mike demonstrating Rail Brawler. I did not understand what was going on.
Rail Brawler was his thesis work. Mm-hmm. The idea behind it being that in order to take advantage of motion controls and specifically striking certain poses, mm-hmm. that striking poses will sort of give an intrinsic feedback to players. So if you want to make the character stretch and become tall in the game, you have to put your arms way up over your head. If you want to make the character block, then you put your arms up in front of you. The idea that making these poses will make the player feel similar to what the character action is. So that way it's not like you have to make the controller rumble when you get hit. It's just like, okay, I want to make a blocking pose. I better feel like I'm blocking.
Okay. And I guess that also, by making the gestures like more intuitive like that, like you just do them without thinking about them. Like, yeah. You know, oh no, something is going to hit my guy. And you just kind of throw your arms up in, like, you know, the esoteric dodge, only now
it does something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's basically what his work was. I don't think he ever got good feedback into whether or not he was successful with that, but he did make something out of it, and that was the idea, and his idea did come through in that. Like, and, you know, maybe because he didn't get, like, it was just sort of creator bias, he was like, yeah, I think it's working, but yeah, it's a neat idea. And as far as, you know, we've talked in length about motion controls before. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a pretty important way to go. The idea of just, you know, it's not about how fast can you flick the Wii remote around. It's how are you going to hold it? What are you going to... Where does it make sense to do such an activity? And then there was the other one, which was Dreamcatcher, which was basically WarioWare Connect.
I didn't see that one. Where was that set up?
Directly behind our table with the giant projector. It's just that it was being projected towards us, so we just saw a large back of a projector screen the whole time.
Oh, okay.
It was pretty cool. You stand in front of there and you go through a whole bunch of mini games, like catch the ladybug in the jar. But then at like the more mini games you get in, the more bizarre they got. So if you got it early, it was catch a ladybug in a jar. If you got there later, it was catch a UFO in a jar. It was, and it was just like different sort of childhood activities or playtime things. Mm-hmm. So there was like playing with a T-Rex and you just bash him against the building until the building falls down. Mm. But there was a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Later there was a Metal Gear Rex. And later there was Socrates who wrote Oedipus Rex.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was also one that was just, you move your hands up and down, and you make a panda eat bamboo. Later on, the panda has a top hat and monocle. You throw a piece of meat to a fox to play with him. You protect a spaceship from UFOs and star meteors.
Star meteors? Just,
yeah, star meteors. Okay. They're meteors who are famous. And that, yeah, you just kind of do that for a while. It was pretty neat. It was it was simple, and it worked. That was the thing about it, that they took some time and they made sure that everything kind of just worked. It never really felt like it was awkward and that you were missing out on gestures or anything like that, because it was simple. There were some other games. Oh, Feast. Did you get to look at that?
No, their equipment was still overheating.
Yeah, because I was able to hear some of the team dynamics, and it kind of came down to somebody was just being dumb, but nobody could agree on who. But they built their game in Unity, and apparently something was, some script or some model was being loaded and run more often than it had any right to, and so it always overheated whatever phone you're playing it on.
Okay.
Even the phone that they got from, that they borrowed from somebody else that was like three times as powerful as their development phone. But it was in
all of that, it was like an augmented reality game for Androids, right? For Android phones.
Right. And the idea was like, you look at the sheet of paper and you can move around it, and the sheet of paper is basically like an animal pen and you play a giant dragon, and so you gotta try and like arrange yourself to sneak up behind the animals and then tap on the screen to flick your tongue out and eat them. But if, like, you showed up in front of one, then they would get alerted and start scrambling, and some of them have special powers. Like, some would dig underground and hide for a while, some would panic, cause other ones to panic, some would, like, run in a straight line and just get out of there as fast as they could. So, it seemed pretty okay. They were just, they had a lot of development trouble. But it was pretty solid. I would have liked to have seen it work more often.
Because
Then I might have gotten a chance to play it.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen it work, too. They did have cookies and stuff at the table, though, so that was nice.
Yeah.
But I'm just remembering the other game that I did actually get a chance to play, which was Sand.
Yeah, Sand.
Sand was pretty good. Did they place or anything?
No, they didn't.
Really?
Now that I think about it.
I know Jesse really disliked it, but, you know, he dislikes lots of things that are good, because I guess this is the Shit on Other Game Devs and Jesse podcast.
Well, he played the, like, Create Sand class?
Yes.
Okay, because that was one thing that we explicitly told them over and over again in our playtesting session, was that, hey, playing as a sand maker is, like, the least fun I've ever had in a video game. So, that's not necessarily Jesse being a punk. That was the problem with their game.
Okay.
Because their game was designed very specifically to be 3-on-3. So that means if you were playing with less than 6 players, it became entirely unbalanced and unwinnable for the shorter team.
Yeah.
But also, if you were playing as the Create Sand, all you can do is create sand and run around. And you need to rely on the other players to save you, which does not work.
Don't you still get weapons as the sand creator?
Well, you get, like, the standard shocky quick sunny gun.
Yeah, you get the laser.
But it's not, like, It still sort of puts you in just like a struggling, constantly passive role. Like, it almost puts you in a survival horror game.
Because the way that game worked is that you were fighting over each team's ability to populate the map with their sand. So you had the sand creator, who could make sand. You had the attacker, who could destroy the enemy sand. And you had the support guy, who could move sand around. You know, try to clump the enemy sand together so that the attacker can go wreck it and try to, you know, spread yours out so that they can't just come blow it all up. I really liked it. And then you got to pick a different weapon and support ability. So, like, you could teleport or move really quickly for a short amount of time. And then you either had, like, this laser, which had longer range, or this area shock, which was very short range, but you didn't really have to aim it.
Mm-hmm.
And then once either team got, like, map control with their sand or whatever, like they populated enough of it, it went into like this quick deathmatch mode where you just had to stun the enemy team and then you win. Which, and it's also played best of three, so like you could fight over, you know, placing the sand and then get into the deathmatch mode and then just not finish them off, and the games could kind of drag on for a long time.
Yeah.
Which was kind of a problem with it.
That was kind of the problem with their game for a long time, is that they actually sort of did a bit more planning and started actual sort of building development later on. So on paper, their game was very sort of theoretically sound. Like, yeah, there's three classes and abilities are divided up and you have to work together. But then when you actually got down to playing, a lot of things just didn't work out.
And like, they didn't have a lot of time to test and rehash things.
Yeah, like, they did not do enough playtesting. Because the first time we playtested it was, like, one of the, like, the first time they had more than two players testing it. It was still only three. And we quickly found that there was a prevailing strategy, which was to use the teleport, which at that time could teleport directly to your cursor regardless of where you were. And immediately on landing, use the AoE attack. So that way somebody could just jump to you and stun you. And by the time you got unstunned, they were ready to jump and stun again. And
yeah.
That was undefeatable. So they had a lot of things that they did, a lot of like polishing and math balancing, like with times and durations, and they needed to balance a lot of that, because a lot of the game was balanced around that. Because there was no, like, resource gathering. It was all just use it up, and then wait, and it'll recharge. Which, you know what? That happens in a lot of games now, and so that's pretty good. But it was very unbalanced still. And really, they should have made it just 2-on-2, or found some way to make it scale. Because to only be able to play it with 6 players,
yeah.
They were like, they're like, well, if you have less than 5 friends, you won't be playing our game. It's like, well, then you won't have any players. Because even if you have 5 other friends, getting them together to play the same game can be a pain.
Especially because there's no, like, local.
Yeah.
You need 6 machines all running it.
Yeah. Which they knocked out power a few times.
Yeah, they did.
So. Yes, and I'm looking over here, and I'm trying to think if there was anything else that was particularly notable. I mean, there was Dimensional Warfare, which I don't know how actually cool that was, because it seems like it was like 3D is invading 2D land. Now this 2D guy is going to invade them back, and he was like a run around, shoot stuff in 3D kind of game. It was pretty competent, but again, it had that student game feel to it.
Yeah.
But nothing outstandingly wrong with it. I don't know who made it, but there might be this one, Carnero. It was a game, another one built in the UDK, but it was kind of Metroid-like.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of run around in an abandoned starship, and you got to turn systems back on because there's some sort of treasure deep inside the starship to get. Yeah, it was all the way on the far side. I stood over and watched it for a little bit, but I didn't get a chance to play. But it was like you unlock like freezing powers, and if you use that, then you freeze a whole room, and then machines in the room move slower, so you get to use them for platforming rather than just getting crushed by them.
Cool.
It has some stuff like that going on. Yeah. So that seemed pretty good. But again, like, a trained eye would know that they were, like, although it looked really good, that's because UDK looks pretty good by default, and, like, they were still using the default gun model for like, all of their weapons, and, like, a lot of the, it didn't look like there were too many custom textures, and some of the ones that were custom were, like, they had this problem where they had this green hexagon that said press E to use, and they would put that on stuff that you would activate. The problem is, like, unless you were already up and touching it, it just looked like a green hexagon, and the letter E faded out. So you did not realize that that was something that you could use, because it just looked like a decoration. So they had a couple of problems like that. But again, you know, a Metroid game, that would be fun.
Yeah.
And I'm looking over here. There was Aesir and Deserted and Dimensional Warfare. No, we talked about that. Flutter, Good Question, Thrive. I don't even remember seeing some of these games there. The Dual Quaternion Skinning Tech Demo was not a game. I remember them sitting across from us, and they were not a game. Did you see A Knight in Twistwick Manor?
No.
Neither did I, but they got, like, fourth place.
Yeah, I have no idea what that is.
I think they were trying to be... I think they were the closest thing to, like, an actual adventure game.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they were chosen because even though they weren't quite as polished as other things, they had a lot of content.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of a lot of things to discover in the game. Like, it wasn't, like, a lot of content, like, our one hallway is really, really long. It was, like, actual, like, go around, discover, open boxes, there are notes to be read, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had, like, that is where they put all their effort into, just making that kind of stuff. So that's cool. But yeah, like, there wasn't too much that... No, that's not true. There were a couple of things that really stuck out. Like, not stuck out because of how well they were made, but stuck out because they were sort of original and they were going for something cool, but... It's also kind of a shame that you can't actually go play most of these things.
Mm.
I mean, you can play VS Nitros, but...
Which is a pretty good game.
Yeah. I don't know. Does it sort of give you a hope for the new developers who are coming into the field? Because, you know, that's sort of the idea of it, that these are all student projects for students who want to become, like, full-time game developers.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you like the idea of the kind of people who will be working on up-and-coming projects in the real world now?
I don't know, man.
There were games with grappling hooks there. That is probably a good sign.
Yeah, there were games with grappling hooks there, and that's a good sign. I mean, it was a mixed bag. Like, you know, a lot of these games did have promise, and a lot of them were just kind of like, okay, here's my project. I'm done now.
Mm. Yeah. Because there was also... It wasn't just RPI. We had another school come over. I believe it was Champlain. They had Champlain College come over, and they were showing off some of the games that their students had made. And apparently they have a very different system. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of the games from the RPI students were made in half a semester. Like, our game was made in half a semester.
Yeah.
Rail Brawler was actually built over the course of about a semester and a half because it was an independent study thesis project thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them, it's like we were in classes where, at least the class that I was in, the way it was structured was, we make a game by ourselves the first week. The next 2 weeks, we make a game with a small team. And then the rest of the semester, we make a game with a full team.
Okay.
But some of these other ones, they've been making these games for a whole year at least, if not sort of over the whole course while they've been in the program. And with much bigger teams. Like, you just look at the sheet. Like, a lot of the RPI games have between 1 and 5 names on them. Where these Champlain games have at least 6, 7, 8, 10 on each team. So it's... And yet, you know, one of the things that game developers say is that sometimes being in a games class doesn't actually help. Like, sometimes the actual best thing that you can do if you want to make games... Is to just go out and make some games. Like... the guys who originally made Tower of Goo, which I guess is what became World of Goo. Because
mm-hmm.
Tower of Goo was just a Flash game.
Yep.
And the way that those guys did it is they just made, like, they had, like, 1 week development cycles. Where, like Sunday, they were like, okay, here's what we made from last week. Now we're gonna pick a new, like, mechanic or theme to play around with. And then everybody goes and makes a game. And then they come back next week and they show off their games. And it's just enough time to look at one mechanic, to play around with it, to see how you can use it, and to try and, like, polish it as much as you can, and to get, like, one really tight, concise game. And you can do that in a week. And then they just keep doing it. So over the course of the month, they have 4 games from each person. And if you have 5 people doing it, now you have, like, 20 games that have been made. And if you want to do anything, if you want to keep developing anything, well, now you have a big batch of games to see where the most promise lies.
So you have a large group to... for mechanics and shit.
And you have just, like, a large group to say, like, well, here's what we tried, here's what worked, here's what didn't, and you have a better chance to work from it. Whereas, you know, both of these school programs is kind of like, well, we basically, like, made one game as a team each, so if we did it wrong, oh well.
You all collaboratively learned how to do something wrong.
Kind of. I mean, that's the way VS Nitro works, is we made something, and then we got guys from Vicarious Vision came over to sort of give pointers to everybody who was there, and they basically convinced us that we need to redesign most of our game. And we did. So, that's why when we got done with it, the actual gameplay we had, we thought was pretty concise, but, like, we didn't have clearly explained rules, we didn't have a how-to-play tutorial level, we didn't have, you know, our actual website was, like, thrown together the morning of. So. But it's a learning experience, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yes. You are going to school.
Yeah. So I think
that's kind of the intent.
Well, I'm done with school now.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Good job.
Yeah.
You going to devote your life 100% to StarCraft now?
No, I don't like StarCraft.
Right.
Going to go on to the professional Tetris Attack circuit.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, as far as the Game Fest goes, I'll give like a quick Google search to see how many of these games actually are online and we can give links to. At the very least, VS Nitros is up there, and RPI's Game Fest page has a little blurb on it. Other than that, you may be kind of out of luck. And then, show notes, we found at our website, leekustudios.net/podcast. If you want to know more about anything, or you want to tell us about some stuff, you can email us at podcast@olikustudios.net. Follow us
on
Twitter.
You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, in the iTunes Music Store.
Yeah. Although right now, if you follow us on Twitter, it's mainly just that you get updates about when the podcast is going to be late.
But that's useful information.
Yeah. And now that I'm done with school, I'm actually, like, going to jump back into working on Underside mods and Neo Tokyo mapping, and maybe going to be working with Paul to do some Left 4 Dead mapping.
Cool.
And I'm gonna actually have creative output again. Go back to finally drawing Aloof.
I was kind of thinking that, like, at some point this summer we should just chain ourselves to some desks and, like, hash out some Neo Tokyo shit, because, like, we both started working on that.
No, I'm telling you, man, we got to do... It's not about saying, like, here's the day where we have the creation party, because if it's just a day, we're not going to do much. We got to be like, we got to have, like, our creation content Thursdays back. I miss those.
Mm.
But that is for another time. As for the podcast, I believe we're done here.
I think we are also done here. So, have a good night.
Yep.
See you next time.
Later, people.